Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. As the U.S. opens up again for tourism and travel, you might be thinking of venturing out. Maybe Seattle sounds appealing. With ferries crisscrossing the Puget Sound, fishmongers throwing fish through the air at Pike Place Market, and boats passing through the Ballard Locks. That's where spectators can get up close and personal with 700-foot-long fishing boats. If Seattle ever is on your travel itinerary, a new book will fill you in on the region's rich natural and human history, one that goes well beyond what popular travel guides offer. David B. Williams is the author of Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. He joins us now. David Williams, I want to go way back in time. Who were the Puget Sound's first inhabitants? How much do we know about them?
It's an honor to be here. Tenery, thank you for interviewing me. The story of Puget Sound, as far as we've been able to tell, dates back at least 13,000 years. There's a site, an archaeological site on the east side of Lake Washington that basically was a quarry where people collected material for projectile points and hammer stones. And that's the oldest really well-accepted evidence in this area. And then as we move forward in time, we see throughout over the net subsequent 13,000 years, people living in this area adapting and evolving and utilizing the resources here.
And so I assume so much water that they did a lot of fishing, or do we know kind of what they subsisted on?
We know that we don't have any mammal parts or fossils from that particular site. We have from other sites a kill of a mastodon and a bison that may or may not have been done by people, but we certainly know they were here at the same time. What's perhaps most interesting is the only bone found at this site was a salmon bone. And what's, I think, amazing is that both humans and salmon had just moved into this area of Puget Sound because it had been scoured by ice and there had been no one here during the ice age. But then the ice melts out, salmon come into the salt water, humans come in, and that connection between people and humans, between people and salmon, starts right then and continues all the way up to present. So this just amazing record of that relationship between people, their natural resource, and the place they live.
And how about, we'll jump quite a bit forward in time, the first explorers. It wasn't just the British, right? I mean, were Spanish there? Who do we know found it first?
Know that George Vancouver arrived in what he named Puget Sound for one of his lieutenants, Peter Puget, in May of 1792. But we also know that the Spanish had arrived in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, which connects Puget Sound to the open ocean, much earlier, 10 years earlier. They had just failed to come down into Puget Sound. So we have a record of Spanish people preserved in many of the place names at the north end of the sound, something such as Rosario Strait, the San Juan Islands. But then Vancouver comes down into the sound and really begins that process of European settlement in this part of the world.
And did they run into native peoples? And what did they think of the climate? Had they experienced anything like this? Do we know?
Yeah, it's a good question. Climate, we probably assume that they were used to it. They're from Britain, and London and Seattle basically have the same sometimes dreary climate. I know in your part of the world you don't get rain like we do. But
not in Utah.
When the British came in, it was interesting. They saw and it certainly met with and traded and corresponded a bit with the native people of the area, the Coast Salish people. And the British sort of opinion of them was very typical of the era, they did not well regard the people. They thought of them as primitive, as dirty, as violent. And yet you look at what native people had very similar thoughts of these are very strange, very different people. And what's one thing that is striking is that when Vancouver comes into the sound, he starts to see people who have smallpox. And even though the British had not made it down into the Sound, smallpox had already previously gotten here. And they were getting here as the population was starting to be decimated.
And how did it get there? Do we any ideas?
There's some guess that it may have come from the Spanish shipwreck out on the coast, and then it just traveled by people, or it could have come overland by just native people corresponding with each other as smallpox sort of traveled across from east to west across the North American continent. So it's not clear, but we do know that the effects were probably upwards of 60% to 90% of the Coast Salish people were killed by smallpox or other diseases.
Hmm. I want to go back to something you mentioned about the Ice Age, because that did so much to create the Puget Sound as we know it right now. I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of the ecological history that formed the sound and also the land masses in the shapes that they are. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I see the world through geology. So for me, this is always a fun question to answer, sort of getting my favorite thing. Mm-hmm. So 18,000 years ago or so, a big sheet of ice called the Puget Lobe of the Cordilleran Ice Sheet, which is the big ice sheet to the north. Basically, it's a finger that extends down out of Canada between the Olympic and Cascade Mountains. So Puget Sound is surrounded on mountains on the east and surrounded, and then also on the west. That ice pushes through, extends to about 50, 60 miles south of Seattle, which is down by Olympia, our state capital. When it goes through Seattle at its maximum, it's about 3,000 feet thick. A little bit to the north, it was 5,000 feet thick. And so that ice scours the land, and water, curiously flowing underneath that ice, etches out Puget Sound, cuts into the sediment below, digs very deep into that sediment. The deepest spot of Puget Sound is 900 feet, average depth about 200. Compare that to, say, San Francisco Bay or Chesapeake Bay, which have average depths of like 10 to 30 feet. I mean, these are 30, mm-hmm. 40 feet, very shallow bodies. Puget Sound very deep. And because of that depth, you have this incredible array of life here, of species from the very deepest all the way up to the surface, taking advantage of that ice-sculpted landscape. And in addition, the ice then hit harder parts, harder geologic sections, and created there's underwater ridges, and those affect the current as the water flows in from the ocean and out from the ocean during the tidal exchange every day, and it mixes and circulates all the sediment or the nutrients, the larvae, and some of the pollutants. So the geology is central to understanding both the positives in terms of some of the nutrient load, but also some of the negatives in terms of some of the pollutants staying longer in Puget Sound. So it's definitely a landscape of geology and ecology that mix together to form this sort of really unique body of water.
I'd like to start, because you mentioned nutrients, with kelp, because I want to talk about some of the interaction between life and the feeding cycle in the Sound. So tell us about the importance of kelp.
Yeah, kelp is amazing here. I think many people know the big terrestrial rainforest that we have in Puget Sound. But underwater is this equally complex forest of species. Kelp, there's 18 or 20 species in Puget Sound. Probably the most famous are the bull kelp, the ones that look like a giant turkey baster with a big streamer on top. Those can be 70, 80 feet long. And so they're the overstory species. They're the big towering trees, if you will. And then there's an understory of other kelp in the Sound. So it's this very three-dimensional ecosystem. And because of that, it provides habitat for a huge range of species, from really small invertebrates to crab, to all sorts of different fish. Orca ply through there. And so it's a nursery, it's a safe haven, it's great habitat. And then the kelp itself is incredibly rich in carbon and other nutrients. And so everybody's eating it in one form or another. the detritus of it, eating the plant itself, and so that kelp carbon circulates throughout the marine ecosystem, and it's an essential part of the ecosystem here, and it's sadly, like many things, it's also suffered over time due to habitat loss, to how we've changed the ecology of the waterway. But what's positive is that people have recognized the importance, and this is a central theme for me in my book, is that people have begun to study it, better understand it, and are there ways to do some restoration and improve that habitat and protect that habitat. So to me, it's very much a positive story of science working together with restoration, with people concerned about protecting and preserving the unique environment here.
And tell us about herring, would you? Because I love this phrase in your book. You call them the hub in the wheel of the sound.
Yeah, and I just think that's great. It's this idea that everything revolves around herring. And so kelp may be the most important plant. Herring is arguably the most important fish in the ecosystem. And we're, of course, known for our salmon, as you said at the beginning, the tossy. You go to the Pike Place Market and they're throwing the salmon. It's this great thing. No one throws herring. They're not an attractive species, but everybody eats them. They're just at the right size where they eat lots of little things, all the little nutrients, the microscopic and the macroscopic nutrients in the waterway, plant, other animals and such. And then they, in turn, get eaten by everybody else. And so...
And when you say everybody, you mean everybody in the sea.
I mean everybody else. People, all and not just in the sound, all sorts of fish, lots of birds eat them, mammals come down, eat the eggs, take advantage of whales. It's this sort of riot of life, particularly when they have their big spawning event, and there's bazillions of them in the water. And so, yeah, it's just they are really this hub, and that was a central point for me, that the two species you've brought up first are ones that are often overlooked, and I wanted to explore species that were often overlooked but were then essential to understanding the story of this place.
Well, and before we leave herring, I want you to tell us the story. I guess you have a story of catching a bait ball, and I did not know what that was. So you please tell us what a bait ball is and how many fish you caught in one go.
Yeah, bait ball. Yeah, those are pretty fun. So schooling fish like herring, and there's a couple others like them, they can get basically sort of harassed by other animals, either fish or birds, into what's basically a big teeming ball of life that's, tens of feet across with just tens and hundreds of thousands of fish, because the fish are relatively small, swirling around. And I was lucky enough to go out with a biologist one day in a little Zodiac, a little classic rubber raft, and we would seek out these bait balls, and the way you tell them on the surface is by this abundance of gulls that have swarmed in to try and eat all these fish. I mean, it's just this crazy, crazy abundance of life. So we would take our Zodiac, drive into the sort of ball, the bait ball area. The gulls would scatter. I had a net, like a 4-foot wide net on a 10-foot long pole. I would then jam into the water and sort of lever out. And we got like 5,000 to 10,000 fish at a single time. I mean, it was so cool. Sadly, we didn't get herring. We were looking for them. We ended up getting a different forage fish, but equally representative of just the bounty of life that is in Puget Sound.
Well, a fish like herring, or maybe some of these other, you call them forage fish, which all the other fish are eating, when there are pollutants in the water, that can be a real problem, right? Wouldn't this be kind of the vector for passing pollutants up the food chain?
Yeah, and sadly that is a problem. They are that sort of idea of bioaccumulation, that the microscopic critters are getting pollutants in them, and then the larger critters eat them, and then then eventually the herring eat those, and then eventually the salmon eat the herring, or the orca eat the salmon, and so you get this accumulation. And that is one of the problems with the toxins in the sound. We've done a much better job over the last 20, 30 years of reducing the toxic load by preventing the big industries that dumped a lot in. So things are improved, but it's still a problem, and we do see that in one of the things they've discovered in the Orca and Puget Sound, which are really struggling here, the population, is this accumulation of toxins, and it has effects. These are animals that are very family-oriented, and they affect the learning and the sociability of the young orca. Huh. So it's definitely problematic we're seeing with this bioaccumulation. That's a really good point to bring up.
We're speaking with David B. Williams. He's the author of Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. In just a moment, we'll meet orcas and gooey ducks. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and our guest is David B. Williams. He's the author of Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. Now, my favorite thing I think about Seattle, and I lived there for a few years, is the ferries. It's regular transportation for a lot of working folk. I mean, like a train or a taxi, but it's just so romantic to me. And I heard that you decided to ride every ferry in the Puget Sound. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was a fun project. So one of the chapters in the book focuses on what I call Puget Sound, a maritime highway, and thinking about how did people move through this landscape, this very challenging geological landscape with all the hills, the valleys, and then once the forests take over, it's just a hard place to move over land, so people would have moved by water. So I wanted to explore the canoe culture of the native people, what was known as the Mosquito Fleet, this early armada of vessels that just sort of went everywhere, privately run, a mix of boat sizes and types, and then get into the ferry system, and which, as you point out, which is this really sort of romantic aspect of the Sound. And so I thought, okay, I'll try and ride every ferry in Puget Sound, and 98% of them are managed by the Washington State ferry system. It's the ones that most people know. But there's a bunch of little county ferries, and there's a city ferry, there's a couple little private ferries. And so I just thought, oh, what can I do? How can I ride all of them? And so I took about a year to do it just because of timing. And it was really pretty amazing to do. And I think the thing that stood out most for me was a ride with one of the ferry captains, a woman named Marcia Morse, who's worked with the Washington State Department of Transportation for years. And we were talking about being out on the ferries, and she made this observation that in a landscape like Washington with the dense forests, so often you hike, you're in the forest, and you don't have these big views. But when you're out on the ferry, you have this big view of the landscape. And she said there's this spiritual aspect of being out on the water. And I thought that was a really profound way to think about part of the reason they are romantic, if you will, because there's just something about being out there. You have the potential to see whales. You see porpoises. You see all sorts of birds, bald eagles. You have this incredible view of the mountains. And it combines with this very practical aspect of just going from point A to point B. So to me, the ferry system is so central to the story of the Sound and that deep history. So when you ride a ferry, you're doing something that people have been doing for thousands of years, traveling across the waterway and probably looking up and going, wow, this is just such an amazing place to be.
And Ed, you talk about the deep history of travel across the Sound. There's something called the Tribal Canoe Journey, and I guess you actually went there and observed it. Will you just paint that picture for us?
Yeah, as I said, canoe culture was the predominant way that people moved for thousands of years, and there's been a revival of it over the last 20 years as the different tribes have really promoted within the tribes, and there's what's called now the canoe journey, and it's this gathering of literally over 100 different canoes. And these aren't just like the two-person canoes that we're all so familiar with. These are these great boats made of cedar trees that can hold 8, 10, 12 people. And to see them paddling in, I was lucky enough to experience one of the canoe journeys as it landed near Seattle, in Seattle a few years ago. And just this overwhelming sense of connection to landscape and sense of pride and joy within the community of people as they were paddling in. And again, this idea of connecting to place, of understanding the story of a landscape, of understanding who we are as a people, and both as European settlers, but also as the indigenous people, is what I was trying to do in the book, was to understand how do we fit into the world around us. And the canoe culture, the canoe journey, to me is just a very profound way, certainly, that I experienced from talking to Native people.
Hmm. Let's get back to some of the fish and wildlife connected with this sound. Of course, the salmon is famous and so delicious. And I just like to know, remind us how they find their way back every year to spawn, because the science behind that is so kind of magical and mysterious.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time, no one really understood, but it's sort of a combination. And the primary one, certainly when they get back close to their birth stream, so most of the salmon are anadromous fish in the sense that they're born in freshwater. They then head out into the salt water, and they may be gone for a year to 3 or 4 years. Then they find their way back, and they're traveling hundreds of miles, and they do it through chemical means. They're able basically to detect the chemistry of their birth stream and to follow it back once they get closer. So it's sort of astounding to think that animals, that really anyone could do that. But I think it's one of the great gifts that we've been given from science is looking and going, wow, these animals are just superbly adapted and evolved to place and to find their way back. And that's just, to me, as you say, it's an amazing thing to see and to know about.
Now, there's a smaller fish that doesn't get quite as much, does not get top billing, but you call them in your book the most quintessential resident of the Puget Sound. I'm talking about the rockfish. Tell me a little bit more about them and how are they faring today?
Rockfish are really interesting. They're beautiful fish. There's something like 28 species in Puget Sound. They're incredibly diverse, from about the size of a paperback up to, you know, as long as a tennis racket. I mean, there's some big, huge range. And what I call them quintessential because all those different species together, they fill basically every niche in the Sound, from the deepest water up to the surface. They're there also, one of these fish. The smaller ones get eaten by lots of things. The big ones eat lots of littler things. And sadly, many of the species have suffered over time due to overfishing, mainly because we did not understand their biology, as opposed to a fish like a herring, which basically has essentially an annual lifestyle, or salmon that maybe live 2, 4, 8 years. Rockfish can live 80, 100, 150. The oldest rockfish known was one that was 205 years old. So a completely different way.
Wait a minute. How do you know how old a fish is?
You ask. What's amazing about fish are like trees. They produce a little bone called an otolith. It's an ear bone, and it adds a new ring each year. So you harvest the fish, you pull out the bone, and with a microscope, you look and count the rings of the otolith, and you get the age of the fish. And we didn't know this until only the last 20 years or so, 30 years, as people have started to collect and realize the great age. But it leads to a completely different management cycle because their reproductive rate is so slow, and on a scale where instead of it being, you know, you could reproduce very rapidly, it takes a long time for them to build up the population. So as we've begun to understand that, then we've begun to realize how to be better managers of the fish. They're still struggling, but at least we now have the knowledge to help them get back to where they were, or at least back to higher numbers.
Now, I said I lived in Seattle area for a while, and I remember one of my first summers there. We went to the shore, and we were clamming, and we found these giant clams, and we were so excited. We had this huge bucket, and we were kind of there ahead of our friends who had grown up in Seattle, and they showed up, and they go, "Ugh, those are just gooey ducks." And I thought, what's wrong with gooey ducks? And these are maybe sometimes a maligned species, but maybe that's changing. Will you tell us a little bit about gooey ducks?
Yeah, gooey ducks are interesting. They are a clam with a shell about the size of a really, really big baked potato, or like a giant sweet potato that you've seen in the store. And then they have a neck or the siphon that sticks out, and those can be 12, 18 inches long. I mean, they are, for many people, they are just disgusting looking because of what they look like, and it's not. But they are also arguably the most abundant life form in Puget Sound. There are hundreds of millions of them, and for many years, up until really the last 30 or 40 years, biologists thought that they were a species that were only found in the intertidal zone, so the area between high tide and low tide, and you'd have to dig down to get them. Gooey duck is actually a Lachute seed word, which is the native language of the area, meaning dig deep. But we subsequently realized that they are found in underwater down to 300 feet in depth. Hmm. So incredibly abundant animal, and have over the last few years, again, last couple decades, have become something that have been harvested very widely and primarily shipped overseas to Asia. And one of the highlights for me was to go out with divers from one of the local tribes as they would dive down. We were about 60 feet deep water, and they're, you know, this sort of classic Jacques Cousteau-looking breathing apparatus underwater, pulling up these crazy-looking animals, boxing them, and then shipping them, and they would be in China the next day. So they've really this huge ecological impact, but also we've realized, again, another one of these species, as we begin to understand, just a part of that full fabric of the ecosystem. They're nutty looking. People usually gasp when they see them.
And are they tough? Or, I mean, how did the Chinese prepare them, do you know?
All sorts of different ways. They're done as sort of thinly cut in sushi, but they're also cooked in hot pots. I talked to a lot of the tribal people, and they said, you know, any way you can imagine. They steam them, they put them in stews, they barbecue them, they eat them raw. I have to say, I've had one in my freezer for a long time that I failed to eat, and I should have. But, people really like them.
Is there a danger of overfishing
over-harvesting? They are so incredibly abundant. And they're also, again, a species like rockfish that have this incredible lifestyle, that the oldest known gooey duck was harvested just north of Seattle, and it was either 173 or 174 years old, which I just think is astounding to think about a species to have an individual that's been here and sort of experienced the whole story of Europeans moving, all the changes in the landscape, all the changes in the waterway, to me is a pretty remarkable thing.
Now, gooey ducks don't have that ear bone. How do you know how old a gooey duck is?
Same way, their shell, they just add a new layer every year. You take a shell, you cut it open, and with a microscope, and count all those layers in there. They're definitely done by people with a lot more patience than I have.
Oh, now, I've probably saved everybody's favorite for last here, David Williams. Orcas regularly visit the Sound, and you actually open your book and end your book with the story, a really poignant story of an orca mother. Will you tell us that story?
Yeah, this is the story of Tilakwa, who a couple years ago, she was one of the matriarchs of the what are known as the southern resident killer whales, the group down here in Puget Sound. And she had given birth, and sadly her baby died within 30 or 40 minutes. And then she carried that baby on her back, sort of propelling it through the water for the next two and a half weeks. And it really became this worldwide symbol of the sort of the beauty of this area, then of this whale, the incredible intelligence, devotion of this animal, and then the sadness of a mother and her dead child, and that ability to not want to give up. And so I use Tilakwa as a story illustrating the sort of what is going on in the Sound, that we're really struggling here. And if she can't survive, what does it? What if Tilakwa and her child can't survive? What does it mean for the human species? And then bring it back at the end and thinking about that she gave birth last year, and so there's this sense of hope, this new life emerging. And so for me and for many, the Tilakwa and Orca really do symbolize the story of the Sound, of the challenges, the potential, the science, the beauty, the connections that we have with this place, and not that just we have, but that the species also have to this place, that we're all in this together as this sort of big family of species.
And so you're hopeful for the health of Puget Sound?
I am hopeful, Tenere, yeah, and primarily because I think we have made a couple of changes. We now no longer view the Sound primarily as a resource, which it had been viewed for decades to extract salmon, herring, trees, and we now have this relationship that I think is much more based on sustainability and stewardship and the knowledge of what we need to do. And no, we're not going to go back to what it was when George Vancouver arrived here in 1792. But the fact that people are concerned that animals here and plants have a resiliency, we give them the chance, that potential exists. So that gives me hope that we can work together. It's not going to be easy, but I think we do have that potential to create a better Puget Sound for all species.
David B. Williams is the author of Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. Way down the coastline from the Puget Sound, you come eventually to a place called Santa Barbara. That's where we're headed next. We're going to learn about a coastal ecosystem threatened by climate change. And we're also going to hear about the strange fish that depend on that ecosystem. We're talking grunions next on Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Today we're talking about a couple of dynamic ecosystems along the Pacific coast. We're going to move south now, actually, from the Puget Sound to Southern California, a place that is home to a very special type of fish, the grunion. Despite breathing with gills, as fish are wont to do, these fish spawn on land. They flip across the beach in great droves during the grunion runs. In recent years, overfishing and climate change have threatened their fragile populations. And we spoke recently with Karen Martin, a professor of biology at Pepperdine University, to learn more about these fish. I asked her about the first time she witnessed a grunion run.
I tell you, I had heard about them when we moved out here. I moved out here to work on my graduate program, and I'd heard about them, and I had to go see them, of course. And it was incredible. It's just an incredible thing to be sitting on the side of the ocean, listening to the waves and watching the stars overhead, and all of a sudden fish start appearing on the shore right at your feet. It's wild.
Is it a gradual thing and then a more active thing, kind of like the rhythm of popcorn starting slowly and then more and more and more?
That's a good analogy. Yeah, we usually see just a few at the beginning, maybe just one or two or a handful of them coming up, and they immediately rush right back down. And then over time, they'll stay a little bit longer, and a few more will join them, and you'll start to see more and more of them on shore. And you may, if you're really lucky, get to see the whole shoreline just covered with these beautiful silver fishes just dancing around in the moonlight. It's quite a sight.
So these are literally fish out of water.
They literally are fish out of water.
They ride the tides up?
They surf in. They're the California's original surfers, so they read the waves really well, and they'll take one that's going to take them fairly far up on the beach, exactly where they want to be, and that's when they'll drop out. The wave will rush back into the ocean, and they'll stay up on the wet sand and do their thing.
So I don't know the technical terminology for this, but do they hold their breath? I know they got gills, but do they hold their breath?
Yeah, that's a great question. They do have gills. They don't have lungs, and they don't exactly hold their breath, but they don't actually breathe air either. They have a lower metabolism. They're very calm when they're out of water because they've chosen to do it. And so their heart rate slows down, and they're able to stay out for several minutes, which is really long enough for them. But they can't stay out a really long time. They're not air-breathing fish.
And do some get stranded?
It's pretty rare, but it does happen. Sometimes if they get caught behind a big piece of kelp on the shore, or maybe there's a slope backwards on the sand, and so they get behind it. They can't get back out again. But it's pretty rare. Most of the time, they'll make it back.
Now, this is all about reproduction, right?
It is.
So they spawn on the sand, on the surface of the sand, just flopping around there, males and females.
What happens? Kind of. So what happens is that the females will actually use their tails to dig a little hole in the sand. It's very soft, liquid almost, when the waves are washing over it at that time. She'll dig herself in, and she'll start to release her eggs into the sand, and then the males will see that and come and visit her and deposit their milk to fertilize the eggs.
So the
eggs are actually buried about the depth of her body, about 10 centimeters to 20 centimeters deep.
She buries the eggs, and that would be for what purpose?
Well, the reason is because those eggs, because of the timing of the runs, it's always right after the highest tides in the middle of the night. And because of that timing, the tide then goes out for a couple more weeks between a full and a new moon, and then as it comes back up again, it's going to wash those eggs free. So what she's actually doing, being a very good mom, she's putting her eggs in a place where they are going to be out of water but buried under the sand, so very safe, damp, cooler than being on the surface of the sand, of course. And they're going to develop out of water, and they won't hatch until the very moment that they get washed out into the ocean again.
And how much time elapses between their being deposited as eggs and then getting washed back out to sea?
Well, if you think about the phases of the moon, they're going to run on the highest tides, which are coincident with the phases of the moon, of the full moon and the new moon. So that's every 2 weeks approximately. So what they'll do is, as the tide is falling a few days after the full or new moon, that's when they'll lay their eggs, and then as the tide rises up right before the full and new moon, that's when the eggs will get washed out. So usually about 10 days or so. And what's really incredible, I mean, that's incredible enough, right? That's pretty cool. But what's also really incredible is that those eggs, if they're ready to hatch, they'll hatch almost instantaneously if they get washed out, whatever time that might be. So if it takes a little bit longer than 10 days, if it takes 12 days or 14 days, and they wash out, they're fine. They'll just hatch right out. They'll just go about their business.
So they hatch once they're back in the water, once the eggs have been washed out into the water.
As they're being washed out, they're actually hatching within a few seconds. It's incredible.
Now, one of the more incredible things to me is that the fish would have any way to calculate when that high tide is going to be. Has anybody cracked that code?
No, they don't ever reveal their secrets quite to that extent. The thing is, though, that there are quite a lot of marine animals, especially, that respond to tides. Of course, the animals in the intertidal zone respond to the tides because they are regularly covered with water and then exposed to air, depending on their height. But there's a lot of animals in coral reefs and in other places, even when the ones that don't come out of water, that really respond strongly to tides. So the animals are responding. They have a swim bladder, which is a gas-filled space in their bodies that can respond to pressure. And it may be that that's what they're feeling, or they may be feeling the currents of the tides as the tides rise and fall. But we know that they definitely respond to the tides.
This is just really remarkable. It's one of those, you know, I have had conversations on this show about birds and their ability to navigate and turtles and their ability to find their way from here to there. A lot of navigation stories, but just the fact that somehow fish would time this out perfectly is really remarkable.
It's impressive. It's definitely impressive.
Now, let's talk about, okay, the fish. We haven't even talked about the size of the fish. You talked about how many centimeters deep they bury it, but what's the average length of grunion? They're not very large, are they?
They're not. You know, about 150 centimeters would be about, I'm sorry, not centimeters, 150 millimeters, about 15 centimeters. So fairly small, about the size of a butter knife or something like that. Not very big.
What's the point of trying to catch them? Are they good eating?
I don't eat them. I don't really recommend eating them. They actually have a lot of parasites. We have friends who study the parasites of grunion, and they said they've never seen a grunion without a parasite. Most of them have three or four different kinds. Plus, they're very small, as you say. There's not much to them. Plus, it's so much better to just watch them and just enjoy the cultural and the amazing, beautiful spectacle of the run rather than trying to think of them as something that you need to figure out how to consume.
Do people congregate on the beaches in great numbers? I know you've been down there a lot. is it just a mass of humanity showing up to watch this?
If people are quiet and if people are in sort of small groups, then you can come and watch the grunion run. There are some really wonderful public programs that a couple of the aquariums along the coast have done. And in those, they're very good about making sure people behave in the way that will encourage the grunion to be safe and to go ahead and run.
How would the fish know that there are people in great numbers? Is it like they make it halfway there, and then as they're out of the water, they say, oops, I'm turning around?
So one way would be people are noisy. People are noisy and talking to each other and yelling, and it's exciting to be on the beach at night, and people are running around. And so it's not like, you know, when you go bird watching and people are real quiet. It's generally a little bit more more wild than that. And then they can hear that. They'll hear that noise, and they'll feel the vibrations of the people running on the shoreline. And also people will run into the water and, you know, look for them with their flashlights and shine their lights on them. So it's pretty easy for the fish to tell that there's lots of noise going on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the habitat, the range where they are found. I think of this as being, I don't know, from maybe Santa Barbara south and down to the tip of Baja?
It's not quite that. It goes down to about, the traditional range is about Santa Barbara down to about Punta Abriojos, which is about halfway down Baja. But with climate change, we're seeing them move and they're shifting northward. And so what we're seeing is fewer and fewer in the southern area and more, even more north of Santa Barbara, all the way up into San Francisco Bay. We've got them all the way up even farther north than San Francisco Bay now. In little populations that are spawning up there. So we really are seeing a change in their movement patterns and in their behavior with the climate change, which changes in the ocean warming.
I've driven from Santa Barbara to San Francisco, and that's a number of miles. This is a significant shift, isn't it?
It's hundreds of kilometers. Yeah, it's a huge shift.
Yeah. Well, what is the place of the grunion in terms of the ecosystem? Who's relying on them for food? What's ecological, I don't know, what's the term, services do they perform? It's kind of funny to talk about an animal performing ecological services, but maybe people talk that way.
Sure. They're what we call a forage fish. They're a small, you know, easy-to-eat fish for a lot of animals. And so when we try to keep track of all the animals that are eating them, it's everything from marine mammals like seals and sea lions and dolphins all the way to the birds. Even the small birds will eat the smaller juvenile grunion, and leash terns, for example, which is an endangered species, eats the juvenile grunion and prefers them, picks them up when they're hunting for their chicks. And pelicans and all kinds of seabirds, of course, will eat the bigger fishes. Their eggs on shore are eaten by a different set of birds, which would be the ones with the long bills, the sandpipers and things like that, that are coming along feeding on these eggs as they're flying down the Pacific Flyway for their migration route, and also the ones that live here on the beaches. So they're really important in the food web for just about anything that would eat a little fish. They'll find a way to eat the grunion.
You have been involved in monitoring the grunion populations and with the group of volunteers who are watching them, the grunion greeters. This goes back, I think, maybe a couple of decades for you.
Yes, it does. We started in 2001, 2002. So, yeah.
What have you seen in the way of a trend over time with the population? Are they diminishing in considerably? Can you even take a census of grunion and really know how many there are?
It's always hard to try to take a population census of any wild animal because there's undoubtedly things you're missing, and that's always true, but we just have to do the best we can. This particular fish is really hard to monitor because they don't come up in trawl nets the way that a lot of other fishes do, and even though it's a recreational fishery, the fishermen are not required to report their catch if they do catch them, and so we don't have those kinds of information that we might get from other kinds of fishes. And so the best way and really the most consistent way to get that information is with our volunteers who go out onto the beaches at the specific times that we expect the grunion to run and watch and see how many they actually see coming out that night and then report those. And we have a web interface so they can report them. We get them immediately once they do that. So this is something that we have really dedicated people who have, some of them have been doing it for decades individually. And all over the coast, all up and down the coast. This past weekend, I got reports from all the way from San Diego all the way up to Mollis Bay. So it's pretty great to get that kind of coverage, even under the circumstances that we're in right now.
And they only spawn from about April through early June?
Well, in Southern California, that would be the peak time. That's the time we usually monitor. But they actually could spawn as late as August. And especially up north, they don't even start until May. They're just starting now. And they'll continue on into August.
Where are they hanging out when they're not on the beaches spawning during this time period? Do they go far out to sea?
That's the big question. This is one of those questions that nobody really knows the answer to. As far as we know, they're not near shore except for close to the times when they're spawning. They're not necessarily easy to find. We're not able to find them at other times. So what they're doing probably is going deeper into the deeper layers of the water and then possibly nocturnally coming up towards the surface at nighttime. But that's not when we usually do trawl surveys. So it's just a really good question. Nobody really knows the answer.
Ooh, I love it. These are the kinds of stories from nature that leave you probing and wondering, and there's a bit of a mystery to it, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the grunion greeters. How many are there, and what is their function? You started this group.
Oh, we've trained over 5,000 people in our workshops, and just anybody can actually do it because we have an open web portal that people can go to. But the reason we started was because I was concerned about beach grooming activities, and that means that beaches get raked and cleaned up by heavy machinery. And there was concern that that was causing problems for the grunion. So we did a study and found that, yes, if they ran over the grunion eggs, that definitely would be problematic. It's fatal. So what happened now is that the grooming practices have changed over the whole area where the grunion run so that doesn't happen anymore. And also people are still going to see the grunion because it's awesome and it's fun and they enjoy it. The other thing that we've been able to do was to try to look at the record over this long period of time that we've been doing it. And the record shows that there has been a decline in the kinds of runs that we see on the beaches. So we have a scale, we have kind of a ranking system from 0 to 5. 0 would be you don't see any fish or you see one or two fish. 5 would be the whole beach is covered with fish for over an hour. It's incredibly beautiful and amazing. And then everything in between. And what we've seen is that the rankings have gone lower in general over the years. Unfortunately, even though we do see the occasional really nice big run, those are few and far between. They're fewer and farther between than they used to be.
I just have to ask if there are any predators that take advantage of this vulnerable spawning season. Are there birds that are nocturnal that are coming and picking them off?
Oh, that's a great question too. Yes, is the answer. We have a if the beach that the granite they're running on is close to some place where the birds would normally roost, like if it's close to a lagoon or a state park, for example, then there will be birds out there, night herons especially, great blue herons. We've seen even seagulls and egrets and, you know, birds that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see active at night. We did a study not too long ago about this and found that the birds that were there waiting for the grunion, they're actually there before the grunion show up. So they're responding to the tides too, probably. And then they're not there on the nights when they don't, when we don't expect to see grunion. So they know what's going on too.
You keep piling on the mysteries here.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And then also, if you look out in the water, you can see sea lions and dolphins and other things that are chasing the grunion. People will fish. We have had things like little smoothhound sharks or guitarfish come up out of the water chasing the grunion up onto shore. Wow. And they quickly hurry back into the water after they catch them.
There have been some mighty interventions where humans have changed the coastlines with filling, and I guess there's a seasonal need for renewing the beaches with sand. Is that what the beach filling refers to?
Beach filling can refer to just putting new sand onto a beach from some source that's not present, right?
And this is to prevent erosion of the coastlines, where you just want to keep the beaches where they are?
It's it's to protect properties and it's to protect recreation, and so people will bring in sand from other places sometimes and place it on the beach.
And this has been a problem for the grunion.
It can be, certainly, because what can happen is that especially if it's happening during the spawning season, it can bury the eggs or it can disrupt the runs in that particular location. So definitely it can be a problem, especially during that season itself.
So what's the very best advice you have for anybody who cares about preserving grunion and seeing their populations maybe improve?
We have a lot of people who are working on trying to maintain sandy beaches in California, because obviously it's a place people love as well as animals, and it's really important as part of our cultural heritage to always have a sandy beaches that people can go to and that the animals that depend on them go to. So I would say learn more about the natural functions of the beaches, the animals, and the plants that are important on those beaches, that depend on those beaches for their life cycle, and try to use the beach in such a way that those processes can continue, that those animals and those plants can still share that wonderful space.
Karen Martin, distinguished professor of biology at Pepperdine University. She serves as chair on the board of directors of the Beach Ecology Coalition. After a break, we're going to take a trip to the Louvre. Chances are you hear that name and a specific painting comes to mind quite easily. It's not very big, you know. Super tight security around it, though, and throngs of tourists press close to see it. Mona Lisa may be the shining star of the museum, but if you're not careful, you may miss another significant piece of art in that very same room with Mona Lisa. Turns out that painting has a story all its own. Coming up next on Constant Wonder.